Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Federal Habeas Corpus Law Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 4th, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Cullen v. Penholster. The questions in this case were the following. 1. Under federal habeas corpus law, is review of a state court decision limited to the record that was before the state court that adjudicated the claim on the merits? And 2. Did the state court unreasonably apply clearly established federal law? In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court held that 1. Under federal habeas corpus law, review is limited to the record that was before the state court that adjudicated the claim on the merits, and 2. The state court did not unreasonably apply clearly established federal law. To discuss the case, we have Ronald Eisenberg, who is the Deputy District Attorney for the Law Division of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Eisenberg.
When Cullen v. Penholster was argued last November, it seemed that the Supreme Court might once again decline to decide a major issue of federal habeas corpus law that's been eluding resolution for several terms. Instead, the decision, announced at the beginning of April, becomes another in a series of significant habeas cases this year that will, if faithfully followed, reshape the process of collateral review of state criminal judgments in the federal courts. Scott Penholster was, by his own description, a career criminal in Los Angeles who committed hundreds of robberies. He was also a white supremacist and often carved swastikas into his victims' property. On one of these occasions, Penholster brought two cohorts to break into a house and steal its contents. Two friends of the homeowner had the bad luck to come by the house at the wrong time. Penholster attacked the men, stabbing them repeatedly in the chest. Both victims died. Penholster boasted that we got them good. Weeks later, Penholster and another perpetrator were arrested. Penholster made it clear to his friend that if he testified for the state, Penholster would kill him. But testify he did, and after hearing a wealth of additional evidence, the jury convicted Penholster and sentenced him to death. All of that was almost 30 years ago. Ever since, Penholster has managed to delay the sentence through appeal, first in the state courts and then, since the year 1997, on federal habeas review. After various ups and downs, an en banc panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit threw out Penholster's death sentence on the ground that the real party at fault was his trial lawyer for not putting on different evidence in an effort to mitigate the sentence. The United States Supreme Court then took the case for one primary reason, to determine whether a habeas petitioner is allowed to present new evidence in federal court after the state courts have ruled on the merits of his claims. The question arises from two adjacent paragraphs of the congressional statute governing federal habeas corpus review. The long title of that statute is the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. It's usually referred to by its acronym, AEDPA. Section 2254 of the statute contains two important subsections. Subsection D1 deals with issues of law. It says that a federal court cannot substitute its view of the law for the state courts. Once the state court has ruled, a federal habeas court can reverse it only if the state ruling was so out of line that the correct result is not even reasonably debatable. Subsection E2 deals with issues of fact. It says that a habeas petitioner cannot present evidence in federal court that he could have presented in state court. The problem is this. What if the defendant wants to use E2 against D1? In other words, what if the defendant argues that the state ruling may have been reasonable on the evidence as it existed at the time, but that the ruling becomes unreasonable when considered in light of new evidence that the defendant is presenting for the first time in federal court? Can he do that? Now we know the answer, and it's been a long time coming. The issue has been debated at several oral arguments before the court in recent years, apparently to a draw, and the cases were disposed of on other grounds. This time, however, the court spoke clearly in a decision by Justice Thomas. We now hold that review under Section 2254 D1 is limited to the record that was before the state court that adjudicated the claim on the merits. The court explained that the fundamental purpose of AEDPA is to change the prior relationship between state and federal courts. Under AEDPA, federal courts no longer have the power to correct state judges they disagree with. Instead, their role is simply to rein in the outliers, the rare state court decision that is so out of line that no reasonable judge could agree with it. To that end, said the court, federal habeas review must focus on what a state court knew and did without regard to evidence that it never heard. New allegations raised for the first time in federal court simply cannot be considered. If the state ruling was within the wide bounds of reason, federal habeas review is at an end. What was surprising was not so much the court's result, which incorporates concepts from many prior precedents, but the court's configuration. Habeas cases, especially capital habeas cases, often come down 5-4 in the Supreme Court. The vote here, however, was a much larger 7-2 majority, and with an unusual lineup. Both Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kagan joined Justice Thomas's opinion on this point, while Justice Alito, who supposedly was to be joined at the hip with Justice Scalia, broke from the majority to vote in dissent with Justice Sotomayor. In a normal habeas case, in a normal year, that might be news in itself, but Pinholster is in fact simply the culmination of a line of unanimous habeas decisions issued this term. Between January and April, the court has issued 5 separate opinions reversing grants of habeas relief that did not comply with AEDPA. Each of these cases came out of the Ninth Circuit. But the very strong language in these opinions, of course, will apply in all the circuits. It is impossible to dismiss the conclusion that the court has lost patience with inferior federal judges who look down on state courts and who don't like AEDPA's constriction of their own powers. The full court expects the circuits to give the statute its full effect. The effect in this particular area of habeas law will be significant, especially for capital cases. Most habeas cases are decided on the state court record. There are relatively few federal evidentiary hearings. The more serious the case, though, the more likely a hearing for new evidence, and death penalty cases are the most serious matters on the federal habeas docket. Most often, the new allegations concern exactly the kind of evidence Pinholster offered here. Mitigation evidence to try to influence the sentencing decision. Mitigation evidence can cover just about anything concerning the defendant's life. As a result, there's always more out there. Another expert offering another opinion about the defendant's impaired mental state, another relative offering another anecdote about the defendant's terrible childhood. Now, after Pinholster, all that factual litigation should come to an end. If the state court ruled on the merits of the claim, the record is closed. As important as this holding may be, there was actually a secondary issue in the case that's also worth comment. While the evidentiary hearing issue is the one that will grab the biggest headlines, at least for habeas practitioners, the other ruling in the case may wind up having the bigger impact. Normally, after removing from consideration the new evidence presented in the Ninth Circuit, the Supreme Court would have remanded the case to allow the Court of Appeals to reconsider Pinholster's claim on the basis of the record as it existed in the state court. But the Ninth Circuit streamlined the process here by offering an alternative holding addressing exactly that question. Was the state court ruling unreasonable, even without regard to the new allegations Pinholster presented at the federal evidentiary hearing? As it so often does, the Ninth found that the California Supreme Court failed the test. The merits of Pinholster's claim, therefore, were ripe for review by the Supreme Court. As death penalty cases go, that claim is a pretty common one. My trial lawyer provided constitutionally ineffective assistance of counsel because he presented some mitigation evidence at the trial, but not enough, or not the right kind. This time, the voting lineup was somewhat closer and along more traditional lines, 5-3, with the so-called conservatives in the majority and one justice, Breyer, declining to reach the question. But that is still a majority, and it said some important things about how courts must analyze such ineffective assistance claims. First, said the court, the controlling case here is Strickland versus Washington. That may seem obvious. Strickland is the landmark precedent on ineffective assistance of counsel. In death penalty cases, however, the lower federal habeas courts have tended to favor instead a trio of more recent decisions, Williams v. Taylor, Wiggins v. Smith, and Rompilla v. Beard. The courts have read these cases to require capital counsel to investigate every aspect of the defendant's life. The failure to do so has been treated as virtually a per se violation of the Sixth Amendment. Dozens of death penalties have been overturned on this ground. But Williams, Wiggins, and Rompilla didn't really establish such a rule, and the Supreme Court has finally made that clear in Pinholster. The court declared that these three cases are merely specific applications of the Strickland rule, particular to their own facts. There is no threshold requirement of investigation. All that matters is whether the overall mitigation presentation has some reasonable basis. The court also made another crucial point about habeas review of ineffective assistance of counsel claims. A state court's rejection of such a claim cannot be overturned unless it was, quote, necessarily unreasonable. The court used this language several times in its opinion. The phrase is significant because it emphasizes that the test is objective and deferential. It doesn't matter what the state court was thinking, and it doesn't matter that different judges might have disagreed. If there is any basis on which the state court could have reached a debatably correct result, habeas review is over. And that kind of deference must be accorded not only to the results reached by state courts, but to the actions of trial lawyers. Many lower federal courts have limited their analysis of ineffectiveness claims by considering only the explanations actually proffered by counsel for their conduct. If the lawyer's articulated explanation doesn't make sense to the court, relief is granted, even if the same conduct might have been justified in some other way. In this case, for example, the Ninth Circuit refused to consider what it called fabricated excuses that the attorneys themselves could not conjure up. The Supreme Court rejected that approach and returned to first principles. The court reminded the lower courts that Strickland itself requires an inquiry into the objective reasonableness of counsel's performance, not counsel's subjective state of mind. Accordingly, courts must do exactly what the Ninth Circuit refused to do. They must entertain the full range of possible reasons that a lawyer may have had for doing what Pinholster's lawyers did. This is game-changing stuff. If federal habeas courts really do what Pinholster says to do, results will be different in many future cases. Then again, perhaps the court should never have had to write the opinion it issued in this case. There is nothing truly revolutionary here that could not have been discerned from the language of AEDPA itself and from Strickland. We still do not know how closely the lower courts will be reading.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.